looking at the lay of the land for the upcoming election, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is my co-host, the Vice Chairman of our Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Glad to be back with you here in the studio, Barry, after a very busy week last week. You never know what's going to come up, but I knew a lot of what was coming up last week. We told people last week that I had just gotten back from California, the land of the fruits and nuts, and it is still the land of the fruits and nuts. Crazier things continue to happen. In fact, I heard Jerry Brown is thinking of jumping into the Democratic presidential race.
You know, that reminds me, Chuck, we still haven't done our analysis of all the Democratic presidential contenders, and we're going to have to do that here on another, not today, but
not
on
today.
Another program, so that any of our listeners who might consider possibly looking at the Republican ballot and saying there's nobody I can vote for there might switch across the aisle to see if there's anybody they can vote for on the other side.
Well,
and I say now, folks, don't automatically discount that, because sometimes it might be a good idea to vote for somebody else just to send a message.
There you go. Well, I can tell you this, Barry. When I was in college in 1976 at Ohio State Newark campus, or OSU NERC, as we knew it at that point, Jerry Brown was running for president as the Democratic governor from California. So here we are 40 years later, and Jerry Brown is thinking of running for president as the Democratic governor of California. What's interesting about that was at the time, his girlfriend 40 years ago was Linda Ronstadt.
Yes.
And unfortunately, Linda these days is suffering, I believe, from Parkinson's disease.
Parkinson's,
so she has lost her voice, which is really sad because she had a wonderful voice, although she was, well, a typical Californian, the land of the fruits and the nuts. So yes, she was strange then. I have no idea now, and I pray that she recovers from her Parkinson's disease, although we all know that that tends to be kind of a permanent thing. So again, we pray that she recovers from that. But that doesn't change what's going on in the political picture, although I know that candidate issues are not what we're going to discuss today.
Well, actually, we may be doing a little bit of discussion about that, because as we're sitting here taping this for this Saturday, on Thursday, Wednesday night was the second Republican candidate debate at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California, hosted by CNN. And, of course, they had the 11, what they consider the top-tier contenders, and I really question that. And then they had an undercard of the four remaining who are still polling, but not polling high enough to be considered as part of the top tier. And that bottom-tier group included Lindsey Graham, Rick Santorum, Bobby Jindal, and George Pataki. And it was clear from the undercard that there's a good reason why these folks are on undercard. You know, with the exception maybe of a Bobby Jindal or Rick Santorum, who very well could end up breaking through and picking up some support once part of the field starts clearing out.
Right.
It's very clear Lindsey Graham, his highest aspiration or his best line of the night, according to many folks that I saw the feeds on, were the fact that when he's asked, you know, what would be the thing you would do, first thing you would do if you became president, he said, I'd have to start drinking more. Now, that's right. See, now, that's the reason why he said it, was to get a laugh line to set that tone for people to like him. And, you know, it worked for him, because many analyses say Lindsey Graham won the undercard debate. However, he didn't really win it, Chuck, because what he did was he mainly stood on his defense of having amnesty for illegal aliens and being part of the Gang of Eight and the Gang of 12. You know, he's been all these gangs.
Yeah, he's been a member of a lot of gangs.
He's a gang member in the U.S. Senate.
Lindsey Graham, gangbanger. Yeah.
And he had to go there because Rick Santorum pushed him hard on the immigration issue, which he should have done, because it is a key issue. And that would be the one thing that I actually like, this split debate style structure where you have an undercard and a main event, because usually in the main event, you get what you've gotten in the Fox event and then what you got last night, which was much ado about nothing. Nobody really talking about anything substantive policy wise mainly sniping back and forth across at each other, and because you had 11 voices on the stage and a hostile moderator, nobody really got to create any space for solid policy options.
Again, not a watcher, but from what I'm seeing from clips, it was essentially a lot of the moderators, quote-unquote, standing there saying, let's you and him fight.
Well, that's exactly what they were doing by asking the questions. Well, so-and-so said this or that. Yeah. How would you respond to that? And you know what? I'm sorry to say that almost every last one of them fell for that. That is an old trick to get you to talk about what the moderator wants you to talk about, not about what you're supposed to be talking about, because that's what your campaign's based on. You know, the old saying, you know, when you give a speech is to tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. Well, that doesn't work in a debate format like this. The point is, with a debate format, get in, make your point, get out. That's really the three-step process. And to have the moderator guide you by saying, well, so-and-so said this, how are you going to fight back at him? Well, and of course, many of these guys have got egos the size of this house that we're in doing the recording in. They fall for that bait easily. They get off their talking points and they start talking about anything but what they need to be focusing on, which is, what is the reason or the policy distinctives that you bring to the table that would make you an attractive choice for the voters and would be a good person to become the potential chief executive of the United States?
Right. And you're right. That is a big problem. And part of the test of character is the ability to stay on message when reporters are trying to, you know, pull you over and talk about things that really don't matter.
Right.
If they're asking you about something that points to your character, that's one thing. If they're pointing to something that somebody said, let's see how you react because Joe over here was a meanie.
Right.
Okay.
And the classic example from prior to last night's debate was Donald Trump basically making a snide comment about the fact that he thinks Carly Fiorina is ugly. So, you know, hey, but that's the level of statesmanship that we rise to in these debates, then Chuck, I've got a lot better things to do with 3 hours of my evening time on a Wednesday night, not counting going to church.
Yeah, exactly.
That I could be doing. Watching paint dry on the walls actually is pretty high up on that list above this. This was political theater at its worst. It was managed, manicured, massaged, and manipulated in order to, A, give all Republicans a black eye, because obviously it's CNN, help elevate the ones that they want to elevate, i.e. Chris Christie seemed to get an awful lot of kudos, and so did John Kasich. And you and I both know that neither one of them are really rising to the level of timber of being a chief executive.
No.
And to basically utilize the show pony in the room, Donald Trump, as the stalking horse to get everybody else looking at him and start complaining about him and just look small and petty themselves. The undercard is much more exciting to watch because they actually start talking about policy.
They actually talked about issues.
Right. Yeah. Because the moderators, the mainstream media manipulators already have given you this meme that these guys are the also-ran, so you don't have to worry about them. And they put them in an earlier time slot, so you're not paying any attention to them. But that's where real policy debates start happening. And honestly, I'm really keeping my eye on guys like Bobby Jindal and even Rick Santorum. And remember, Santorum won the Iowa caucuses in 2012.
Right.
Okay, he's not a slouch, and he's been around the block a few times. I wouldn't necessarily say that he'd be my top three of people I'd vote for, but he's not at the bottom of the list either.
Right.
So keep an eye on some of these guys. Lindsey Graham is not going to go anywhere because, you know, this is like the fourth time he's tried running for president, I think. And he hasn't come up with the idea that when you're running as a Republican, you can't run as a liberal.
I'll be quite honest. I was not aware. This shows you how little impact it made. I was unaware that Lindsey Graham had run for president before.
Yeah.
That shows, because he's sort of like the, who was the guy who was the former governor, the liberal Republican that ran? Everybody, the leftist media loved him, and nobody else did in the Republican Party in 12. Can't think of his
name. Michael Bloomberg?
No.
But it was George Pataki, who also had tried it before in 2012. A Republican governor?
Southern governor.
Southern Republican governor. Why is my brain shutting down on this one?
Oh, gosh. The name will come to me as
Rick,
we go along.
Well, Rick Perry was governor of Texas at one point in time, and he flamed out as well.
He's flamed out twice.
Okay, yeah, he's flamed out twice.
No,
because Rick Perry is now officially out of the race.
He's sort of the poster boy for liberal Republicans. Everybody said, why are you in this party? Why don't you switch over? Oh, gosh, can't think of his name.
Well, there was Lincoln Chafee from Rhode Island who actually did switch parties and become a Democrat.
Yeah, that's right.
So he's actually running this year on the Democratic
ticket.
He's one of those people we're going to be talking about in the other program we're going to do. You know what? When it comes to you, let me know, because I can't remember off the top of my head, and I get that, but let's keep moving on with this. Now, when the dust all settles, Charles, you're going to find that really nobody helped themselves or really hurt themselves badly from this debate. The same people who were leading the pack probably are going to stay fairly leading the pack, i.e. Donald Trump. And now it seems like Dr. Ben Carson is picking up some steam. I don't think this helped or hurt some of the middle of the packers. So Chris Christie probably didn't hurt himself, but didn't help himself. John Kasich probably didn't hurt himself. Although it was a very weak response when they started talking about Planned Parenthood defunding, and he basically is throwing up his hands and saying, well, we're trying to figure that out in Ohio. Gee, why don't you go talk to Bob Beasley, who's endorsed you for president, the governor of Alabama, who's already defunded Planned Parenthood? You'd think that maybe he'd reach out to somebody who's already done it. Now, I know he can't reach out to Bobby Jindal, because that shows weakness politically, because Jindal's running against him, but Jindal's already done it in Louisiana. He's in New Hampshire 80% of his time. The executive council of the state of New Hampshire, because of the way their system is set up, they have only like a 60-day legislature, and then everything else gets run by an executive council the rest of the year. They've even found a way to defund Planned Parenthood. John Kasich, sitting in very pro-life Ohio, with a supposedly pro-life legislature, and with all of his executive agencies manned by hand-picked, supposedly with the same political philosophy as he is, cabinet directors, and he can't figure out how to get this done. Chuck, this is beyond ludicrous.
Yeah.
And for full disclosure, I am now the spokesperson for a coalition of 100 pro-life and pro-family groups, churches, civic organizations who have been asking Governor Kasich now for a month, Charles.
A month. 30 days.
Yeah, to take his executive order powers and direct his cabinet officials at the Department of Health or the Department of Medicaid and say, cut off Planned Parenthood and elective abortion providers from funding. If we're sending checks out to Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio or Planned Parenthood of Northeast Ohio or Planned Parenthood of Columbus, stop cutting them checks. And they are doing it, Charles. We don't have the numbers yet for fiscal 2015 because it just finished up here a couple of months ago, but we will probably be getting that soon. But in fiscal 2014, Planned Parenthood, now this is after the governor said in 13 we've defunded them. In 2014, they got $1.3 million from the state of Ohio. Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it correctly. $1.3 million. If you don't believe me, go to Josh Mandel, the treasurer of the state of Ohio's website, the online state government checkbook. You can pull it up online. You can, in the search, type in Planned Parenthood, and it will pull you up every dime that they've received from the state of Ohio over the last 6 years. And you'll see that the 2014 $1.3 million that they received from the state of Ohio is the highest amount of money they've received since 2011 when John Kasich first came into office. Now, saying we've defunded Planned Parenthood, Chuck, that's really not an accurate statement coming from the governor.
It's disingenuous it's beyond disingenuous. It's a lie.
Well, and you know, and even if they said, well, we're talking about state dollars, that's not exactly true either. I will give a hat tip that in 2013, the governor signed a budget that, as one of the provisions in the budget, included a prioritization schedule for state funding for health dollars. And, of course, the highest priority went to the local health, county health districts. And it went down a list, and there were five different organizations or outlets named. And the fifth one, the last one, was Planned Parenthood. Now, that put them at the bottom of the feeding order. So once everybody else got their money, if there was any left, then Planned Parenthood could get some of it. But, again, Planned Parenthood found ways of making that not hurt them at all by then turning around and contracting in many counties, and I know of one specifically because we got information on it, where Planned Parenthood subcontracted with the county health agency that was receiving the money from the state and got pass-through dollars to run programs for the county health department.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it's happening in one county, it's happening. And this was in a conservative county, Hamilton County in southwest Ohio, Cincinnati area. If it's happening there, it's happening in more liberal counties like Lucas County, like Cuyahoga County, like Montgomery County, like Mahoning County, like Summit County, like Stark County. I could keep going on, and like Franklin County. Folks, Planned Parenthood didn't get defunded. They got delisted, but that allowed them to have anonymity to still get the money, but get it in an indirect fashion.
That's exactly right. And the fact is, the whole idea about them getting money, they don't care where they get the money from.
No.
It's about paying employees. This thing about, they're a nonprofit. Do you really assume that people that work in a nonprofit don't make gobboons of money?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I assume because that's what happens with me.
Well, you're not, for instance, the United Appeal.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. That's fine.
How much
that's
does fine. The national chair of the United Appeal make? Do you remember the whole thing in the 90s with Robert Aramone, who was making some just simply astronomical amount of money? Here people are being coerced. And that's exactly what happens in business, is being coerced to give money to the United Appeal, United Way. United Way is what they call it now. Mm-hmm. United Way is scraping huge amounts of money off the top, and then they are giving money to places like Planned Parenthood. And I always had people say, well, why don't you designate your gift, when I was in corporate America? And I always said, okay, here, let me give you a math lesson. The amount of money they take in is a pie. If you look at it as a pie. Okay. So I go in and throw money into the pie. All right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so the meetings are held where they designate how much money is going to go to a group Planned Parenthood. So my designating my money, unless everybody designates away from Planned Parenthood, then some of the money that I designate to such and such a group, it doesn't matter a drop in the bucket, because it doesn't affect the amount of money that's going to go to United Way. Well, they say, well, it doesn't make your money will go here. And I'm like, no, it's not. The United Way money will go here because I told them to do that. Nonetheless, it frees up. All it does is tie up a little tiny fraction of the money that they were going to send to Planned Parenthood. And it doesn't affect the amount of money that's going to go to Planned Parenthood one iota.
Not a bit.
So the next time you get that speech at work about United Way, you know what I did? You know how I handled that problem? My boss basically brought me in and said, we want 100% participation. And I said, okay. And I thought about it and I said, okay, I'll participate. Here's $5. He goes, you mean $5 a week or a month? I said, no, here is $5.
Period.
Now, you know why I did that? $5. It cost them more to account for my $5 than actually went into.
That's right.
Went into the fund.
Exactly. You actually cost them money.
Exactly. That's why I did it. It costs money. And people say, you're mean. It was meant to go to welfare agencies. You know what? If I meant it to go to welfare agencies, I deal with a welfare agency through my church.
Amen. That's exactly right. And that's where we should all be sending our money, is through our tithing agencies. And if you're in a church that doesn't have those, then find alternative places. There are a lot of, as you said, nonprofits who are not making gobboons of money.
That's right.
But are helping people.
Like the Institute for Principled Policy.
Yeah. Well, okay, we're not begging for money for that. But yeah, but I get that.
Yeah.
But the point is that there are alternatives other than going through the politically correct establishment, basically liberal leftist appeal, basically politics of guilt and pity.
Exactly.
Move on the part of your employer, and doing something that you know where your dollars, your charitable dollars are going to actually work to give the services that are needed or to advance the gospel or to help the hurting, instead of going to line some administrator's pocket or help them to lobby Congress or the legislature for more liberal money for groups like Planned Parenthood, which is kind of where we were talking about. Yeah, Planned Parenthood, you know, bills themselves as a nonprofit. They're the most for-profit nonprofit I think I've ever seen, Chuck. You know, when it gets right down to it, this veneer of their nonprofit status,
oh, I know,
needs to be wiped away.
Yeah, all the nonprofit means, it doesn't mean that you don't make a profit. It means it doesn't count toward your taxes.
Exactly. It means that we're registered to say that we're a tax-exempt
right.
organization.
Right. Supposedly, you're using the money for charitable purposes. Using the money, which mostly they charge for, but using the money to provide murder services for babies, I'm sorry, that's not a charity.
No, it's not. It's not at all.
And by the way, just before we segue here, yeah. The person I was thinking of was John Huntsman.
Huntsman, yes.
Who was governor of Utah, not a southern state, so
that's
I'm not sure.
What threw me off. I was thinking southern state.
Yeah. John Huntsman, very liberal Republican.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Okay, well, I'm glad that you came up with that because I was still thinking in southern states and wasn't coming up
Sorry
with the
about
name,
that. So. I threw you off with that that regional reference.
Right. But, you know, going back a little bit on the debates, honestly, at this point in time, Charles, it doesn't really matter who won, who lost, who showed up, who didn't show up at all. And Jim Gilmore will be happy about that because he wasn't even invited to the debate.
Yeah, maybe he's got a kicking chance, yes. But ask Rick Perry about that.
Really, folks, what it gets down to is that coming in December, usually by the 1st of December, these campaigns are going to start filing their paperwork to be on ballots in various states. That's when it matters.
Right.
All of this is just show pony for them to go to big donors to say, look how great I am in the polls. Give me millions of dollars so I can run television ads like John Kasich's doing right now.
Exactly.
He spent $4 million in New Hampshire to try to get in second place.
Well, it's interesting you say that because Rick Perry, after withdrawing, basically the PAC, one of the PACs who sent him a lot of money.
Of course.
We want our money back.
I don't blame them a bit. It's called false advertising.
Yeah.
He knew before they probably sent him the money that he was getting out of the race.
And to show you what you can do with some of that PAC money, I've been seeing ads on TV. This is off topic, but it's not. I've been seeing a lot of ads on TV from the Club for Growth. And what are they trying to do? Are they creating this is in the senatorial campaign that's coming up in Ohio next year. And what they are creating is a negative aura for Ted Strickland. What they are not saying is vote for
vote for or against the candidate.
The Republican candidate. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah.
Rob Portman.
I'm having a bad day today.
That's okay.
They're not saying vote for Rob Portman. In fact, they're running away from saying vote for Rob Portman. They're saying don't vote for Ted Strickland.
Which actually is not an endorsement of Rob Portman. It's actually a backhand slap. Now, it's interesting that you're saying this right now, Chuck, and you brought this particular example up. You and I have not talked about this ahead of time. I was just earlier today having a discussion with a couple of political folks that I know, and we're starting to see certain groups in Ohio that are doing what we call spin and sab moves, okay? That's where we've been backing this guy, we're supporting him, he's great, and then all of a sudden, they stop, they turn and pivot, and they stick a bayonet in him and say, well, you're disappointing us for this reason. Usually, that's a sign of one of a couple of different things. Number one, they're not getting enough attention for their particular interest from the party, and they're saying, hey, you want to get us back on the reservation, you got to give us something. Okay? Or number two, it's a sign that they've been given insider information from the party structure that, hey, we're about to cut our losses on this guy. And so instead of being caught with their hands up in the air defending him, they turn around to try to become the front of the chorus, asking him to step aside. And this is happening to Rob Portman right now. Okay, and I'm not going to name the groups because I'm not going to get petty about it, But there's a particular group. Now, you mentioned Club for Growth doing this.
Yeah.
Non-endorsement, backhand slap. Well, that's one way of getting it done, and that's actually probably the kindest way of doing it. This group actually has come out and actually publicly now is criticizing Senator Portman on their issue. And I'll leave you guys to figure out who that is. And you can find out. It's pretty simple to find it out.
Yeah.
But this was a group that was definitely in the Portman camp and was doing cheerleading for him for a long time. As a matter of fact, they've hosted events with the senator this year. We're not going to, and I'll just leave that to you. You guys can figure out who I'm talking about here. But that's a sign that either the group wants something more from the party apparatus, or that the party apparatus has sent them the signal, hey, you need to get, this bus is about to go over the cliff. You need to get off of it. And I think it's the latter. Honestly, Chuck, they're doing polling, and they know full well that Rob Portman is in deep trouble.
Deep trouble, and he should be.
He has no base left in Ohio. And he's got Ted Strickland to deal with, who actually is no slouch campaigning.
He is one of the senators we have to thank for homosexual marriage in the United States of America.
Yeah, Rob Portman is. Yeah, exactly. And so beyond that, but the other thing beyond that is I've been looking out, and there are certain groups who are upset about the Iran deal that we just made, where we're sending, $150 billion?
Some way too huge amount of money.
Over to Iran. Rob Portman's a co-sponsor on the bill that actually greased the skids for that. But yet the Republican Party's out there trying to laud him as being a hawk and, helping to keep the Iran deal from happening. Where was he on the cloture vote?
Yeah, on the wrong side.
On the wrong side, exactly. So, again, Rob Portman is having a very, very bad campaign season.
Well, again, it's several months before it gets serious. I think maybe what he's trying to, he's hoping to do what Republicans have done and Democrats as well. Do all your bad stuff up late as you can do it, and then do a 180 and show everybody how truly conservative you are for the few months before it comes time to get serious about election, because that's when people pay attention. So you're going to see Rob Portman, my guess is, if he isn't forced out, you're going to see him make a very strong turn to the right.
Right. Or what you're going to see is if John Kasich does, if it looks like there's no path for John Kasich to become president.
Oh, he'll pull out and take
and,
that
and,
spot.
And Rob Portman steps down and John Kasich does for the party. He steps up and runs against.
Takes one for the party.
And runs again against Ted Strickland.
Yes.
And in order to get to the U.S. Senate.
And he has a track record against.
So that he can sit in the U.S. Senate and then run for president in 4 years.
That is Machiavellian and yet entirely possible.
Entirely plausible.
Sometimes when I hear some of these scenarios, I'm like, come on. No, that one is very, very possible.
And I'll admit, some of the scenarios have not panned out that way. But more often than not, when you start reading the tea leaves, you kind of figure out, yeah, that's exactly where they're heading. They're hat tipping. Even before John Kasich announced this run for president, a lot of political insiders were guaranteeing themselves that what he was really doing was setting himself up to run in 2018 when he's termed out against Sherrod Brown for the United States Senate.
Right.
But why run against Sherrod Brown, who's an entrenched regular, if your presidential campaign is going to be floundering and a way to save face is to step in and help the party by taking Rob Portman's place and going toe-to-toe against a guy you've already beaten in Ohio handily?
And who has, frankly, a lousy track record in government.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yes. That's true. Okay, enough of crystal ball gazing. Yes. But you know what? Let's hold this thing because if that happens, I want to say I was there first.
Then we need to mark this. We need to mark this tape. We talked about
this.
We
told you so. That's right. But what we really want to talk about today is actually other things that people will actually be voting on if they go to the polls this November. Because we have, and again, this is an off-year election. When the odd years, it's usually considered an off election because you have no national or statewide big tickets are running. You don't even have like the re-election of your congressman or your state legislature in an off year.
Usually city council.
You got township trustees, county commissioners, city councilmen, dog catchers, you name it. You get all your local ballots. But this year, not only do we have the local ballots, and we have a local tax issue on our ballot that I'm against, but you know, nobody who's listening to this program is going to be like voting in my district.
I was going to say, there are very few, a few, maybe a couple of listers in Gallia County, but not
many.
Not that many.
But there are three statewide ballot issues that voters are going to be facing when they walk into the polls this November. And two of them are actually related to each other. It's a hostile relationship, but they're related to each other.
They are related.
Okay. So when you go to the polls, and I encourage people, if you are registered to vote, please don't set this one out because nobody in your precinct is running or you love your trustees and they're all running unopposed or whatever it might be, because these three statewide ballot issues do have some importance, one of them especially, and we would ask that you really would consider taking care and time to learn about these issues and to also go to the polls. And remember, we have early voting in Ohio. Voting opens 30 days prior to the election. So you can go and pull an absentee ballot or go in and do walk-in voting ahead of time.
Do walk-in voting, yeah.
And I'm looking at the Secretary of State's website right now here in our feed. Voting options, voting early in person, voting absentee by mail, find your polling location. Voting is going to start happening in early October, really. So this is not coming in too early for you. As a matter of fact, we should have done this a little bit earlier.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because as you say, early October, we will be, 2 weeks? 2 weeks from the open of early balloting when this show airs.
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly right. We're going to be a couple of weeks out from early voting. And so you're going to be looking at three issues. Now, issue one on the ballot is,
Let's talk about what's an interesting piece. It's about congressional and state legislative district redistricting.
Realignment
happens every year after the census.
Every 10 years after the census. And we've already gone through this in Ohio.
Right. It's already been done.
So why are we on the ballot again with it, ladies and gentlemen? Well, it's a good question. No, the really reason why is because you have two major parties in the state of Ohio, the Republicans and the Democrats. In every 10 years, when that census happens, the statewide election that's either during that year of the census or immediately follows it within a year or so is the election where you determine who sits on the redistricting board in Ohio to redraw the lines based on population shifts every 10 years. Okay? And the last shift, it was, in 2010, we had the election, or we had the census.
Census, yeah.
And of course, when was our last statewide race? Was in 2010. Before, this last one in 2014. So the nearest one was 2010. Well, there are seven seats currently on the state redistricting board. Four seats, two of them are for House members, two of them are for Senate members, one from each party. So one Republican, one Democrat on either side for House and Senate. So you get two R's and two D's there. So that's an even vote, because the D's are not going to vote for what the R's want. The R's are not going to vote for what the D's want. The other three seats are the keys, and that is whichever party wins these three seats during that regular statewide election gets to fill those three seats on the redistricting board. And those three positions are governor, auditor, and Secretary of State. Chuck, in the 2010 elections, which party won all three of those seats?
Yeah, exactly.
The Republican Party. And they did it again in 2014, but the 2014 race didn't matter. So that meant that there's now 5 Republicans and 2 Democrats on the redistricting board. And so after the 2010 race, they did a redistricting model, and they had hearings and did everything and public input, well, supposedly. And they came up with lines that were effective for the 2012 state and congressional races. Now, of course, if the party has a majority of votes on the board, they get to draw the lines the way they like. And they did. Now, does that mean that we have all Republicans in the State House and all Republicans in Congress?
It's never going to work that way.
It's never going to work that way. But the point is that the Democrats raised a stink about it. Oh, it's unfair. Oh, it's unjust. It's unfair. You're disparaging poor Democrats. My point on this whole thing is, if the Democratic Party wanted to have more balance, they would come up with better candidates who were resonating with more voters in more districts. But the problem is that they're doctrinaire in their holding to their candidates, and they won't let a pro-gun candidate run in a pro-gun district. They won't let a pro-life candidate run in a marginally pro-life district. You've got to walk the Democratic talk. Now, every once in a while, one slips through the cracks.
It happens.
And they get a guy like a Bill Pattman in Cleveland who's solidly religious liberties and solidly pro-life and has co-sponsored a bill to help defund Planned Parenthood in the legislature.
More power to him.
But, in the last election, the Democratic Party recruited a hardcore liberal to run against him in a primary, and they didn't succeed. He won his district because he represented his district.
Yes,
which
exactly.
is the way it ought to be. But now we've got these cries of unfairness, and so because the Republican Party, the politics of guilt and pity work very well against them, it seems, when they get into power, they capitulated and they created this joint commission headed up by 2 former legislators, Vernon Sykes, a Democrat from Akron, and Matt Huffman, who's the former president or speaker pro tem of the House from Lima, and they divvied up this ballot initiative to basically in the middle of the census cycle, let's rewrite all the districts and redo how we do it, and then we'll lock it in for that way so that we will always have fairness and balance no matter what happens with the census or the lines. In other words, we're going to ensure that the Democratic Party has an advantage from this point forward, no matter who wins the statewide elections.
All I can tell you here is that the Republicans realized they dodged a bullet by, because remember, the Democrats won all 3 of those seats, the pivot seats, in 2006.
Yes, they did. That's right.
And knowing that the census was in 10, and of course the results of the census are not released in 10, they're released in 11, which is why you redistrict.
For the 12 cycle.
The Republicans dodged a bullet by not having Ted Strickland win re-election. Now, the fact that Republicans took all 3 seats in 10, because of the frankly awful performance and nonsense like, wasn't it Mark Dan who had to resign?
As the Attorney General because of numerous improprieties, yes.
Jennifer Bruner had to step into the Secretary of State's office.
Yes.
Because of some shenanigans there. So essentially, why Huffman would be for this particular thing? The Democrats were more than happy to run redistricting when they ran the State House and the governorship for the better part of 40 years.
You're right. I may have an insight on Huffman's involvement in this. Because if we rewrite these districts this year, then that means he's looking at a different mix when he runs for the state senate in the next cycle. Because he was termed out last year, so he's running against John Adams, who is a staunch conservative. But if they can rewrite the districts, I'm sure that you're going to find that Shelby and Shelby County may get carved out of that Senate district as a favor to Matt Huffman to keep him from having to run against John Adams.
And don't kid yourself. That kind of thing doesn't go on now, and
yes,
wouldn't
it does.
Wouldn't
and
go
still,
on.
It'll still go on after this is all over.
Okay, here's the problem I see with this thing. They basically want to turn this over to a quote unquote blue ribbon panel. Anytime you turn anything over to a blue ribbon panel, it becomes completely unresponsive to voters, and it becomes completely responsive to special interest groups.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's going to be. And that's the reason why. Now, you know, Chuck, I'd said I knew where I was really at on this, but I, you know, when I came to reasons for why I would say I would vote no on this issue, and I'm just telling you how I'd vote. I'm not telling you how to vote, but I think a no vote's the right way to go on this.
It's a recommended.
I'm recommending that that's how I'm just telling you a heads up. Yeah. This is what my ballot's going to look like. It's going to have a big no check next to that.
Yeah.
But the key is that I got an email from a political acquaintance of mine who's working for the campaign sending me their Facebook page link to like. And I started looking at the page and I thought, you've given me all the reasons I need. Oh, the Ohio AFL-CIO endorses this plan.
Right.
The Ohio Democratic Party endorses this plan. The Akron Beacon Journal, the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Columbus Dispatch, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. I started seeing a trend line. All of the hardcore leftist groups and leftist rag newspapers in the state are endorsing issue one. They want this blue ribbon panel so that they can commandeer it.
Yes.
That exactly. Right there is a good enough reason for me to say, heavens no, will I ever vote for this. No. And I hope that the voting public of Ohio is not gullible enough to fall for this idea of fairness. Well, fairness is, we all go to the polls every 4 years and we vote for who we think will do the best job. And you know what? If the Democratic Party would put up candidates that we could feel like we could trust and believe in, I'm sure that in many districts that's who would win. And sometimes, as we saw in 2006, that's who wins statewide. It depends on the mood of the electorate. This is taking the electorate completely out of the process and actually telling them, we will decide for you who you will be able to vote for.
Yeah, essentially, turn it over to the Politburo.
Yeah, exactly. And it's absolutely ridiculous. So that's issue one. I don't want to waste too much more time on it.
Right.
But we also have issues two and three. Now, issue two was brought to us by the Ohio General Assembly. Yes, they have the ability under our Constitution to bring things directly to the ballot for the voters to vote on. And basically what this says, issue two, the reason, and we'll tell you the reasons why they passed this as a resolution to get on the ballot after I tell you what it does. The amendment, issue two, would prohibit any individual or entity from proposing a constitutional amendment that would grant a monopoly, oligopoly, or cartel, specify or determine a tax rate, ding, 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 or confer a commercial interest right or license that is not available to similarly situated people or non-public agencies. And so basically they leave it up to the ballot board to decide that, okay, well, you know what, it violates the prohibition. So if the ballot board determines it, then there's two separate questions that will go on the ballot. Number one is, should the Constitution be amended to allow a monopoly, blah, 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 blah? And then should this particular monopoly be allowed? So basically, this ballot initiative's issue two is all about naming and putting descriptive terms on everybody else's ballot issues according to what the ballot board. Now, remember, the ballot board is the Secretary of State and a bunch of legislators. Okay, that's who comprises, and there's a couple of public, you know, reps from the public, but mainly it's the political class who decides what does and doesn't get called a monopoly. Chuck, we already have a number of monopolies and oligopolies and cartels in the Constitution brought to you by these same legislators.
Exactly.
Think Third Frontier Commission, okay? Think the casinos. Now, again, the legislature fought on that. Didn't fight very hard. Let's not kid ourselves. They've been fighting.
They're fighting to see who gets the checks.
They're trying to get. But the key is this whole idea of not being able to specify or determine a tax rate. That's what's killing these political types is, how dare you write into the Constitution that we can't tax you to whatever level we want to tax you. That's what issue two is really about. I mean, and okay, I'll give it on one side, because what they're using, they're juxtaposing this issue against the next issue, issue three, which is somewhat incendiary in its topic. But they're trying to do, this is another way where the political class and the legislature is trying to get you convinced to support something that ultimately, most likely, will cause future initiatives from citizens. And you could think the Ohio Liberty Coalition, you could think the right to work folks, you could think personhood, that they'll find some way on the ballot board to say it's a monopoly, cartel, oligopoly, confers a special right or license that's not available to other people. And any issue that the general public or the conservatives would like to see in the Constitution will get branded with this brand.
Yeah.
You know, that steer will end up getting that burnt into its rump. This is a monopoly or this is a special interest. And then it'll be presented to the voters. Hey, should we do this? And do you want to do this one as a monopoly? Chuck, that's a free shot to anybody who's opposing this to run ads saying monopolies are bad. Now, we even heard this today. You and I went out to lunch together prior to taping, and we were chatting with our server about the next issue 3.
That's right.
And what was the response from that server, the reason why they weren't going to support that particular issue?
Monopolies.
Because it created a monopoly.
Yeah.
In other words, the PR campaign on issue 2 has already soaked in to this particular young voter. This is a young lady. And so basically, it says that this proposal would prohibit from taking effect any proposed constitutional amendment that appears on the November 3rd, 2015 statewide ballot, creating a monopoly oligopoly or cartel for the sale, distribution, or other use of any federal Schedule I controlled substance. So they specifically, not only are they going to, like, for all future issues, paint this brush, but they're also saying that if you vote for this one, you will negate your vote if you vote in favor of issue 3, because that's what this is targeted toward, is to block issue. And honestly, they only put that particular rider in there to get people to vote for issue 2, to give them the authority to create this power of the ballot board so that they could nuke everything else. In other words, stalking horse.
Yeah, it's a stalking
horse.
They're
stalking
horse.
You're right. You know, so again, I'm not voting for issue 2. I feel pretty good. I'm going to go no down the ballot, I think.
You know,
I think we're pretty good on that.
We talked about this one this morning this show in its on air incarnation is heard on WLRY.
Right.
We're a podcast every place else. And we talked with the host this morning on, I think, Talk of the Town is the name of the show, Mike O'Reilly.
Yes.
And Mike asked us about this, and I said, you know, if you really wanted, if this were to be a good ballot measure, what it would do would be to negate every monopoly, oligopoly, or cartel that's already been created by the state.
Yeah, well, that would be nice.
And prohibit any in the future.
But it doesn't do that.
But it doesn't do that.
It just prohibits
a single one.
It prohibits the one that may be on the ballot at the same time it is, and any in the future that the political class and the ballot board oligarchs don't like. So this is an oligarchy telling you can't have an oligarchy.
That's right. The oligarchs are essentially throwing you off the oligarchy mountain and saying,
we're the only ones who can determine what oligarchies can play.
Because
I'll guarantee you in the future, if the legislature brings something through this process that they have to the ballot, it will never be determined to be a monopoly, oligarchy, cartel, determining a tax rate, blah, 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 you know, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
They'll get a free pass regardless of what they bring.
I'm going to do a quick definition because sometimes we jargon. An oligarchy literally means eight kings. Now, this doesn't mean that there are eight people involved. What it means is there are a multiple number of rulers, members of this ruling class.
I remember on the ballot board, there's seven, but that's okay.
Yeah. So what it means is there are multiple people involved. It's not a single person. It's not a monopoly would be a single company.
Like a monarchy is a single king.
A single king, yeah.
An oligopoly is a cartel. Well, geez, okay, there are definitions of cartel, and then there are definitions of cartel.
It's a cartel is essentially a grouping of generally private corporations that come together to fix prices. Fix prices, fix business practices, that kind of thing, like De Beers. De Beers
in the diamond industry.
De Beers is a cartel. It's a number of private companies that have come together under the De Beers umbrella who basically fix prices for diamonds worldwide.
Yep.
And they fix how they're marketed, mm-hmm. and they fix how the business practices run, how they're cut, that kind of thing, is all controlled by a cartel. An oligarchy has more, an oligopoly has more to do with maybe a trust, if you would, what we used to call a trust, which are a lot of little companies under a large corporate umbrella. Supposedly, trusts were broken up under the Sherman antitrust law.
Right.
They weren't. They were forced to sell off some of the businesses, and all they did was create other shadow corporations that are no longer part of the trust but are still in the ownership of the people who owned the original trust. It's all smoke and mirrors, folks. It was all designed to make things look like that they were better when they weren't.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, and it's interesting here because there were arguments for and against. And guess who got to write the argument against state issue too?
I'm not sure who.
The Ohio Ballot Board.
Oh, of course.
Why? Because most people didn't know that this was coming. They weren't paying any attention to it. The legislature passed it, and there wasn't a concerted effort by a, you know, private group or citizens group about this issue. So then when the ballot board hears it, they allow the legislators wrote the arguments for, and they, who are legislators and the Secretary of State on the ballot board, get to write the argument against. So the argument against is like three paragraphs. And if you just read it, you would see that, okay, the basic structure of the people's ability to amend the Ohio Constitution by initiative petition dates to 1912. The status quo is adequate. That's their main point. Okay? That really isn't a good argument.
No, that's a terrible argument.
This issue attempts to limit the potential personal financial benefit to the donors who pay for the signature gathering activities, sometimes used to place ballot issues before the voters.
Yeah, they don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, does that smell.
There is no reason to prevent anyone from amending the Ohio Constitution, even if it is for selfish personal benefit, so long as the people support it by a majority vote. I'll tell you what, you want to talk about biased and one-sided.
Wow.
This is a great argument against being an argument for this issue. So anyhow, again, issue two is basically a stalking horse issue, and they're using three as that horse. Okay, Chuck, moving on, let's look at issue three. So issue three is a ballot initiative that does an awful lot of things. The first and foremost thing that it does is it would say that marijuana is legalized in Ohio for medicinal and personal use. And anyone 21 or over can buy, possess, and grow marijuana for their own use. Now, even in the supporters' language, it says that persons are allowed to grow a small amount. There's a reason for that. They're in this language actually tightens down and says that there are only 10 farms, locations in the state of Ohio where marijuana can be grown commercially. Okay? And funny thing is, I think all 10 locations are owned by the financial backers of the group Responsible Ohio who brought this issue to the ballot. So I'll give the folks on the second issue some credit. They actually, the folks on issue three are trying to create a cartel. This is what it really gets down to.
And this is a cartel.
And it is a cartel.
And
it is a problem.
Yes, it is. Endow exclusive rights for commercial marijuana growth, cultivation, and extraction to self-designated landowners.
Exactly.
Who own 10 predetermined parcels of land in Butler, Claremont, Franklin, Hamilton, Licking, Lorain, Lucas, Delaware, Stark, and Summit counties. One additional location may be allowed in 4 years. Well, guess what? I'm guessing that's a predetermined site
as
well.
That's also a predetermined site because I'm guessing probably somebody in Youngstown is going to want a piece of this.
Now, permit retail sale of recreational marijuana at approximately 1,100 locations statewide.
Yeah.
Okay, guess what that means?
Dispensaries.
That means dispensary, which means convenience store that sells dope.
Yeah, basically.
All owned by the cartel.
The cartel, that's right. Now, it's interesting because they're also going to, in this legislation, or this constitutional amendment, if it passes, they're going to create a quote-unquote independent commission that will regulate the growth and sale of marijuana and issue licenses to these 10 facilities and may license additional growing facilities as necessary. Now, we already know, guess how many more they're going to be able to license at all? One in 4 years. That's it.
Yeah.
Once they've saturated the market, now we might let somebody else into the game, and they'll never be able to take over any market share because we will control all of that. And so this is hilarious. And they swear, contrary to unfounded charges, the market established by Issue 3 does not constitute a monopoly, cartel, or oligopoly. Excuse me.
Of course it does.
These charges have been trumped up by the legislature. Yeah, they probably were in some respects, but it isn't because you didn't give them enough ammo to work the gates.
I was
going to
say, when you put that language in your proposal, it's kind of an easy bullet to fire.
When you give them the building blocks for trumping up this thing, they're going to build the tower out of it.
The one I love, Barry, here's the usual thing that never flies anyway. Permits marijuana growing, cultivation, and extraction facilities, product manufacturing facilities, retail marijuana stores, and not-for-profit medical marijuana dispensaries. There we go. Nonprofits again.
Hey, maybe that's where I'll end up with my wads of cash. No, I would never do that.
it allows them to be within 1,000 feet of a house of worship, a publicly owned library, a public or chartered non-public elementary or secondary school, or a child daycare center or playground that is built after January 1, 2015.
Wait a minute. They are or are not allowed within 1,000
feet? It says, permits marijuana growing, cultivation, and extraction facilities to be within 1,000 feet.
Wow. So in other words, drug-free school zones do not apply
to
this cartel.
That's right.
Folks, right there is enough. Regardless of where you fall on the conservative, libertarian, liberal spectrum, right there's enough to say no to this issue, okay? We put those boundaries around sensitive uses for a good reason. Now, I don't necessarily agree with zero tolerance and all that garbage going on in schools, but I do, having worked and talked with pastors and other folks in inner city areas, it's a great idea not to have a drug dealer within 1,000 foot of an elementary school.
It's really good.
Okay? It's just common sense, but obviously Responsible Ohio is being really irresponsible with this. And I know that they've been getting some flack, and I think they should, over their mascot, which is a bud of marijuana, or a person in a suit the head shaped like a bud.
Like a bud,
A bud of marijuana, and they're calling him Buddy. And it's like, well, you know what? Really? Who's that attract? That doesn't attract the folks who are 21 and over. That attracts kids.
That's a kid. Yeah. Remember Joe Camel?
If anybody's ever seen the movie Thank You for Smoking.
Thank You for Smoking, yeah.
They get on air, and of course the leftist is pounding the lobbyist for the tobacco industry, and he's like, well, why would we want this poor kid who's got cancer and is sitting there bald and is a teenager to die? We would want him to stay healthy so he can continue to buy our product.
That's right. Okay, here's two more very important parts. Prohibit any local or state law, including zoning laws, from being applied to prohibit the development or operation of marijuana growth, cultivation and extraction facilities, retail marijuana stores, medical marijuana dispensaries, unless the area is zoned exclusively residential as of January 1, 2015, or as of that date that an application for a license is first filed for marijuana amendment. In other words, Barry, home rules out. If you want to prohibit marijuana sales in your city, too bad.
Uh-huh.
You can't do it.
Right. Well, here's the other thing. Now, this is from the argument against Issue 3, which was actually written and provided by the Manufacturers Association, pastors at churches, the Alcohol, Drug Addiction, and Mental Health Services board members, the Farm Bureau, the Council of Retail Merchants, and the Drug-Free Action Alliance. So all these folks said, here are the reasons why no. Number one, they're going to set their own tax rates, which is what the legislature's worried
about.
That's
the next problem.
Number two, that it legalizes marijuana-infused products like candy and cookies and brownies. You can have that too, and the kids can actually get a hold of that. And that number three, that little small amount of marijuana they said that you could possess, is actually any adult 21 or over in the state will have the right to possess as much as 9 ounces
of
pot.
That's a lot
of
dope.
Or about 500 average-sized joints.
That's a lot of dope.
In addition, every adult could possess 4 flowering marijuana plants at home. Okay. Well, in your household, that's 20 plants.
Yeah, 20 plants. Wow. Well,
oh, my goodness. So ladies, again, I'm not telling you how to vote. I'm not trying to influence your vote. I'm just going to let you know that for me and my house, we will choose the no on all three of these statewide ballot issues.
I think we've laid out enough of the case that there are major problems with this provision. I have no problem with medical marijuana whatsoever. I don't think it ever should have been outlawed. This is a monstrosity. So for me and my house, at least me, and I'm assuming my wife, this is geared toward younger voters. So the one saving grace that you have, it could be both a blessing and a curse, is that it's an off-year election.
It could be, because usually young people are not going to come out in off-year elections. What the people who do come out are usually senior citizens.
Hardcore.
And families who vote regularly anyway.
Okay, that's it. We're out of time for this week. If you have any questions, come on over to the website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And a real quick note, our class that was supposed to start tonight, the night that we're recording this, and I say tonight, it's not tonight, this last Thursday, has been postponed until January. We our room was double booked, and we lost out. We were second choice, so we do not have a room to have it. So it is postponed until January. So you got a lot of time to sign up, and the signups are still available. So again, www.principledpolicy.com, and join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.